It's a Monday. Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Families have welcomed the recent opinion by the Supreme Court, letting stand most of Circuit Judge Watson's order augmenting bona fide familial ties. For winners of the green card or diversity visa lottery, though, proving a bona fide relationship could be more difficult. Following our last segment with Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin, our Twitter feeds, both the show's and mine, became chock full of tweets asking for clarity about the bona fide credentials of those would-be green card holders. We called immigration attorney Claire Hannes, now practicing in her own firm, to walk us through the answers to the queries we got on social media. And Claire Hannes, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
There are a lot of people who don't really understand what this golden ticket of the green card lottery really means. So let's talk a little bit about how the lottery actually allows people to come into the United States and how many actually are allowed to enter our borders.
Right. Well, the green card lottery, or it's also called the diversity visa, is really unique to the United States. It was created by Congress in 1990, and the first lottery winners started coming to the United States in 1996. Now, generally, when we think of green cards or permanent resident status, people get green cards through two primary ways. One is through a family-based petition that a family member files for them, or through employment. There's a third way, though, of getting a green card in the United States, and that's through this diversity visa lottery. There are 50,000 people per year allocated by Congress who can enter the United States through this lottery system.
How come this hasn't really been part of the overall conversation that we've been having now for many, many months about the travel ban?
I think it's probably because it's a relatively small group of people who even win the lottery every year. There are 14 to 19 million people every year who apply. And natives of most countries are eligible for apply, but there are 18 countries that are not. And those are countries that have had more than 50,000 of their natives immigrate within the last 5 years. So countries such as China, Mexico, India, the Philippines, natives of those countries are not eligible for the diversity visa. And that's because the purpose of the visa initially was to try to bring in more immigrants from places that aren't so well represented in the United States. So it makes sense why these groups would be excluded.
Ergo the name diversity visa.
Exactly, exactly. And it's a somewhat controversial program. Trump has talked about wanting to nix it. So, we'll have to see if the diversity visa program is even existent in the next few years. But for now, not everyone who has been selected in the process is affected by the travel ban. Remember, we're really talking about natives of these six countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. But for these people, the travel ban, the 90-day travel ban, has been particularly devastating if they were the lucky few who won the lottery.
And you're really talking about very, very few, because if you say that there are over 14 million people who apply for 50,000 spots, of which, I don't know how many are coming from those six countries, but you're still talking about a few people who really are those lucky winners and now are finding out that maybe that they're not so lucky after all.
Right. So if you're eligible to enter the lottery and then get selected, you're part of about, if you're selected, it's, you have a 0.2-0.3% chance of getting selected. But back in 2015, there are figures that 10,000 people from these six countries, approximately 10,000, were selected to apply for visas. Now, of those 10,000 people, 4,000 of them qualified for visas. Again, getting selected for the lottery is just the first step. The second step is you have to go through the visa application process.
And that seems to be where there's a lot of confusion, because someone who says, okay, I've been selected to continue this process because I won the lottery, is also asking the question, isn't that a bona fide relationship with the U.S. if, in fact, you've selected me to continue that process?
Right. And the State Department actually issued guidance on July 14th that answers that question. And the wording is, diversity visa applicants will still need a credible claim of bona fide close familial relationship or an employment relationship. most green card lottery winners do not have that. They have gone the lottery route because they have no other way, and no possibility ever of immigrating to the United States.
Which again seems to thwart the whole issue of that green card lottery if in fact they're told that's not a bona fide relationship.
Correct. Correct. And it has caused severe hardship, especially for people from Yemen who are not able to consular process to get visas in their own countries because the United States doesn't have diplomatic posts there.
So where have they been going?
Well, most of them have been going to Malaysia, and they've been waiting for over 6 months in Malaysia for their visa interviews, and the visa interviews aren't being scheduled. It's very cruel. These people have given up jobs, sold everything, oftentimes gone into significant debt to get to the United States, and especially if you have to live in a country for 6 months where you can't even work, only to find that you may never get that visa. And then you would have to, I suppose, if they're not able to, you know, go back to their country and try again. But again, the odds of being selected are very, very low.
At this point, with the travel ban set to expire end of September, there are a few days in there that someone might, you know, heavy emphasis on the word might, be able to get into a consulate to have an appointment. But it seems to be that's a very slim chance.
It is a very slim chance. And people have been notified who are waiting that they might not ever get their visas. So the way the system works is you have a period between October and November to apply. And then people who are selected get selected after May. And then there's a period of time for you to where you have to have your visa or that window closes. And so that 3-day period that they will have between the travel ban expiring and their ability to get their visas, the reality is that a lot of them will not be able to. And that's a real tragedy for those people.
So at this point, you're really saying to them, the chances of this coming to fruition for you, despite the fact of having won the golden ticket, is really pretty slim.
Right. And it's something important that, again, the diversity lottery doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but it's something important for people to understand the widespread ramifications of the travel ban, that it affects some, you know, real people in real ways, and this is one group that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but really should.
Thanks very much for helping to shed a little light on it today.
Pleasure.
Claire Hannis is an attorney with almost 20 years' experience in practicing immigration law in Honolulu. She's the former Hawaii chapter chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and an active member of the Hawaii Coalition for Civil Rights. She's now the owner of Aloha Immigration, a law office providing a wide range of immigration legal services.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra and Chorus, presenting French Impressions, 3 p.m. Sunday, August 13th at Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org or at mauiarts.org.
You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, finding a place for Kona Airport's homeless people before this week's sweep. Now, though, your backyard quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolave, uhawai.
A little later, we'll be hearing about an effort underway in Australia to save corals using genetic engineering. But for today's backyard quiz, we're looking at the coral reefs a little closer to home. In the waters surrounding Hawaii, coral reefs form a vast ecosystem that provides shelter and food for countless native plants and native species. Fungia scutaria is one of the many coral reef species that contribute to that ecosystem. Observers have described the appearance of the species as being similar to the underside of a mushroom cap, hence the nickname mushroom coral. But similarities end right there. Mushroom coral is, in fact, a species of stony coral with a hard outer surface. The color of live mushroom coral ranges from a pale brown to dark brown, and specimens will also have a 1.5 to 7 inch diameter. The species is classified as a single polyp, free-living, unattached coral, and is most commonly found on reef flats, frequently lodged into cracks and crevices. Mushroom coral, though, isn't the only name for Fungia scutaria. That's fun enough to say. Though, for today's backyard quiz, we'd like you to tell us the species' other nickname. If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're the first one to get it right, we'll send you our backyard quiz tote to prove it.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Hawaii County has moved up the date of a police sweep to relocate homeless people camping at the old Kona Airport. On Wednesday, all belongings and the people who own them must be gone, hopefully to a more permanent place, according to officials working to help them make the transition. A variety of outreach agencies are looking for shelter placements for those who will accept them and to find additional bed space and other housing options. Assistant Housing Administrator at the Office of Housing and Community Development on Hawaii Island, Lance Ni'imi, is at the nexus of that outreach, and he joins us now by phone. Aloha, Lance.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
So people have been camping out at the old Kona Airport now for quite some time, and originally they were told that it was going to be August 9th that they would have to move out. Why was it moved to August 2nd?
Yes. The Parks and Recreation wanted to give some lead time to help the homeless people get their belongings out of the park, and the goal was to get all of the belongings out of the park and then have a cleanup on August 9th and 10th, a massive cleanup with volunteers, and just to make the park a better place for the public to use again. And so part of the earlier move was to also help the people move their things either into storage that the county will do for a period of time, which is required by law, or to get them moved to alternative sites that we are trying to assist them with.
You've been trying to find additional spaces in addition to whatever homeless beds or shelters there might be for homeless beds. Have you been able to locate many more?
Well, the first effort was to try and really find out how many people wanted housing at the airport, and we did an intensive outreach. And the piece of that went with that was to try and find what the inventory was, to really look at existing inventory and place all of those that wanted to into the shelters and whatever normally is available. And so through that process, intensive outreach and matching existing housing, Hope Services did a remarkable job and stepped up the effort and accelerated what normally would be a longer period of time, and how 17 of the 62 people that had asked for help at the airport, and 17 of 62, that left 45 people still asking for help. And our Mayor Kim, man of great integrity and compassion, asked us that maybe asked us to try and get additional housing availability. So we did a very, very ambitious effort to house an additional 20 of the homeless at the airport at the Friendly Place in Kona, which is an existing shelter for the homeless. And we're trying to, in a period of just about a week, less than a week, to set up this temporary shelter and have the remaining at least 20 of the homeless be located here. And that'll be tomorrow. We're trying to set everything up.
Okay.
As possible.
Today. I mean, so Lance, I mean, looking at all these numbers, of the 62 people, 17 you were able to place, 45 you had to find a place for, 20
Very
of them.
Very good at math, Beth Ann.
20 of them you have now believed that you've been able to find some place for them to be. What happens to the rest of them? And what about the other people who were initially saying to you, hey, we don't want help?
Yeah. So, you know, the 20 that are identified now, we are going to actually go out today and. They've been identified to our case management information system as the most chronically homeless and vulnerable. And so we're trying to house those 20 first. You're right, you know, math is very good, Beth, and at least 25 of the homeless that said they wanted help. Those 25, we're trying to give them information about existing services. We're going out today to share that information and try and really find out how many of them we're able to find alternative housing without our help.
Sometimes,
but it is a concern. There's still 25 of the total 62 that said they wanted help.
Lance, sometimes when we use these terms, you know, the homeless, and try to paint with a broader brush, we lose sight of who these people really are and
yes.
the subgroups. So can you talk a little bit about who these groups of people really are? Are we talking about, you know, veterans? Are we talking about other chronically homeless people? Are we talking about individuals, families? Are there kids involved? Who's there at the airport?
Okay. Families that are at the airport all have been placed. There were actually two, and I'm not sure if they're two different families, but they have been placed through our existing housing inventory. So no families right now. We're talking about all singles. At the airport.
Any veterans in there?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Any veterans in there?
The veterans, I think there were like three or four, and I think those are also going to be placed. So the veterans are covered to our veteran outreach. The rest are primary singles. Of the 20 that we're going to try and house, 12 of them are female singles and 8 males.
So bottom line, what's going to happen come Wednesday?
Come Wednesday, actually, they're going to go out. Today is the 29th. No, today is the 31st. So tomorrow, actually today, we're trying to set up the tents and the housing accommodations, kind of like a civil defense. You know, there was a hurricane today, and we have to do it tomorrow. Pretty much what we're going to try and do and set up the shelter today. Tomorrow at 12 o'clock, those that the 20 that we identified, we're going to have them come over at 12 and 7 and then try to get them settled here.
And any plan for something that's more permanent?
Oh, yeah. The permanent option was something that we've been working on for a while. And it was a private landowner and trying to make all the arrangements. The difficulty with a temporary site that we have long-term potential is that the barriers to get it set up right away were harder than we thought.
So
we're still working on a long-range plan right now.
Today's
effort is a short-range.
So conceivably, then, these folks who will be moving to the tent today, tomorrow, Wednesday, will be there for an indefinite period of time while you try to see if there is a way of being able to procure it more permanently?
Yeah, the site here is temporary license. It's a temporary arrangement. And then some of the people that are here will go into emergency shelter and other shelter arrangements that are available as they become available. We still are in the process of trying to come up with the long-term plan for Kona as well as the other areas on Hawaii Island.
All right. We'll be checking back with you to see how it's going and also what those permanent plans look like. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity for sharing what we're doing here.
Lance Naimi is a former social worker, now the Assistant Housing Administrator for the Office of Housing and Community Development on Hawaii Island. He's been assigned by Mayor Harry Kim to address homelessness in Hawaii County.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
This is Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap on HPR One, with a reminder that tomorrow is HPR's $10 Tuesday. Have you been thinking about how much you depend on HPR's in-depth, fact-based news, or music that keeps you company and lifts your spirits? Then you're ready to become a sustaining member. Join at $10 a month on our first $10 Tuesday, and you'll be making a smart investment. Tomorrow's the day to go online or give us a call.
And Oahu Leeward Valley represents a cultural heritage to those now pushing to preserve it from the threat of development. Civil Beat political opinion editor Chad Blair has today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hey, Beth Ann, long time no talk.
Absolutely, but glad we're talking about this one.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about this part of the Waianae Coast and the valley that is really concerning to those who are living there and who've been trying to fend off development interests for quite some time. Why are they concerned again now?
Well, as our Blaze Lovell reports in his story, and it's a terrific story up on our website today, we're talking about an area called Keaau Valley. It's specifically called Ohikilolo. And folks out on the west side, particularly along the Waianae coast, they've been seeing these luxury developments near Makaha nearby, and they're worried that that might eventually come over into this area. And the area that we're talking about, it's about 600 acres of former ranch land, and there's a concern that people will be looking at it as either a possible landfill or a golf course or a luxury subdivision. As you know, there is only so much land in these islands, and developers are constantly looking for new places, and that's the concern, that we should preserve it rather than have it developed.
When you drive by it, it just doesn't seem like a whole lot to some people. You just see trees and maybe a couple of cows. But why is this so important to the people who are trying to protect it now?
Well, this is what's amazing. There was actually a report some years back that says that there are many hundreds of archaeological sites, that includes a heiau, at least one, that it might in fact be the densest such collection dating back well over 1,000 years. And of course, we're talking about a Native Hawaiian establishment described in this report as once being a very vibrant community. So while it may look like a pile of rocks to some people, in fact, it's something that people in that district, in particular a Waianae Coast resident, an educator who's been pushing to preserve it, says, look, we'd like to not only practice our culture in this area, but also have the public come and learn from it. We can't just, you know, bulldoze this over.
Is that going to be enough to be able to protect it at this juncture? Have you talked to some lawmakers and to sort of, you know, test the waters with them and to see how keen they are on seeing this protected?
Right. Blaze did reach out. Miley Shimabukuro is the area state senator, and she's looking at asking the land board, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, for a state conservation district designation. There's a way that you could call this a traditional cultural property and then thus preserve it. But we can also tell you that for now, the owners, it's primarily a family in Arizona, they say they don't really have any plans to develop it at this point. No current plans, although one can guess that they could be approached again as they have in the past. That's got residents in the area, Cynthia Resentes in particular comes to mind, saying, you know, we're kind of in a waiting game. Here we are again. Will it be developed? Can we preserve it? But for now, we can tell you that at least one lawmaker is seeking to preserve the area through the state.
You mentioned that the Pickering family owns it. Have there been any dialogues with the family to see if, you know, how interested they might be in seeing this protected as opposed to any other way of developing it?
Well, certainly that would have to involve them as the landowner. And Blaze did reach out, and they did say that, you know, certainly they don't see any efforts to develop it right now. One wonders whether there would be, you know, if money's involved to develop it, whether they might change their mind. But the family would have to agree with the state in order to have this area conserved.
Well, we'll see if they do. Thanks, Chad. Good to talk to you as always.
You too, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring political opinion editor Chad Blair. This year, the world learned that Australia's Great Barrier Reef has sustained greater damage than had been previously reported. Scientists say two-thirds of the reef experienced sequential coral bleaching events and that time is running short to save what they can. To that successful end, researchers are trying to genetically augment the protective quality of an algae that live symbiotically with the coral. Rachel Levin is one of those researchers now in Australia. We talked not long ago.
Definitely the numbers have been very alarming, and it seems whenever there's a moment of relief for the reef, before we know it, we're in another period of thermal stress. And part of what is causing issues with that is the corals are not getting enough time to recover from these extreme episodes of bleaching before they're hit with another round. So this is seeming to intensify the problem of coral bleaching that normally may be buffered a bit by some period, cooler periods intermittently. So it is definitely very hard to predict exactly what's going to happen, seeing as so much has exceeded our expectations already. But it is projected that if there isn't more extreme mitigation methods or plans to preserve the reefs that we do have left, that we may lose them within the next coming decade, within the century.
With the continued coral stress that you've just talked about and the fact that we will likely see that as an ongoing factor of life.
Yeah.
How can there be any, you know, reasonable assurance that, in fact, we can do something to mitigate the condition of the reefs now?
Definitely. And I think that's a large part of where our research is looking now. Traditionally, marine protected areas and trying to lower emissions has been the main target of trying to mitigate these effects that are causing coral bleaching. However, we're starting to see that that's just potentially not going to be enough as the climate continues to change faster than evolution can occur in these reef organisms. And that's a bit where our work is trying to step in and at least experimentally see, can we essentially speed up the process of evolution, try to make some targeted enhancements to these key organisms and coral reefs to help them sustain themselves during this rapid climate change episodes that are occurring.
You're talking about more than just seeding a reef with baby coral, but actually changing them genetically so that they might be able to evolve faster.
Definitely. So that's a big aim of our research at this time, is to see, not to introduce any foreign genes into these organisms or introduce any foreign organisms onto reefs, but see, working with the organisms that are naturally there, is there a way we can try to mimic what we've seen in evolution? So looking at comparing some of the types of organisms that are able to withstand bleaching compared to those that cannot, and figure out what are these key molecular underpinnings that are allowing some species to thrive over others. And then how can we use that information to maybe enhance those natural genetic characteristics to help promote thermal tolerance and other sorts of stress tolerances that are known to reduce coral bleaching. So definitely trying to enhance what naturally is found in such coral reef organisms to help them cope with this accelerated rate of change that's happening in the environment.
Rachel, would those be found in all corals, or do we have to understand that some corals may not be able to be well suited to that kind of uptick in evolution that you're trying to create?
Definitely. So I think that's a really good point you bring up, and I think it's a bit of both. Some corals are just going to naturally be able to withstand these changes a bit more. However, if we depend solely on that, we're going to see huge changes in reef structure, because currently the foundation of the coral reef has to do with this massive biodiversity that allows for such productivity in such a concentrated spot. Coral reefs are known to cover a very, very tiny percentage of the sea floor, but are responsible for housing such an extreme amount of biodiversity and productivity in the ocean. So if we rely solely on just let the winners that are naturally going to come out, let those be the only corals that are sustained, we are going to lose so much of this ocean productivity and biodiversity that right now a lot of us as humans and industry rely on for our own economic well-being and prosperity. So what we're looking to do is try to do what we can to preserve the reef structure as we as humans depend on it currently, so that we also aren't impacted as badly, in addition to the reefs not being impacted as badly.
Are certain corals able to deal with some of those changes better than others in the lab? I mean, not what we're seeing clearly out in the ocean, but others that seem to be more receptive to the kinds of changes that you're about, that you're trying to bring about?
So we're still in the early phases to see how manipulative we can be with the corals. And that was a big part of our work, is instead of focusing on the corals, which there are definitely a lot of important work happening in that space, but corals are an organism that take a very, very long time to mature into those magnificent coral heads that you see on reefs, serving as a home to so many different organisms. Actually, we found, and this has been quite supportive through years of research, that the specific type of algae known as Cymbidinium, there's a lot of different variants of this algae, and different Cymbidinium variants have different stress tolerances, and depending on which variant a coral hosts, this can improve their ability to withstand bleaching. So in seeing that natural phenomenon that maybe instead of having to manipulate and then regrow all new coral, we could potentially try to just repartner coral with stronger symbionts, and hopefully through that action be able to more quickly increase the stress tolerance of reefs. So our work is largely looking at what type of Cymbidinium, this algae that corals rely on to grow and support the foundation of coral reefs, and how can we improve this algae, and then in introducing it to the corals, help them much more rapidly acquire thermal tolerance.
So what's the next step in your research now?
So the next step in our research is to try to, in the lab, make these exact changes to the algae. So which specific genes can we help to enhance that are already naturally in the algae? And if we enhance these natural genes, which ones might show the most increase in thermal tolerance and therefore bleaching tolerance? Once that has been established, largely the efforts will need to be focused on, obviously, managing any potential risk that would come with trying to introduce enhanced algae into reef ecosystems, as we want to be really sure that we aren't introducing any negative side effects of introducing genetically enhanced algae.
Is there any hope in your mind that a timeline will be sooner than later that you'll be able to actually create some of the experiments with some of the reefs that are already experiencing, you know, great collapse?
I mean, that is definitely the ultimate hope that we're shooting for, rather than relying on just trying to hope the organisms evolve in time. So that's largely behind our current research, why we've made so much of our ideas and frameworks publicly accessible to all researchers, is we aren't trying to hold on to it ourselves and make it work on our own. We're really going to need collaborative efforts from everyone in the field to help employ these new technologies sooner rather than later, as we are on a tight time frame, as you bring up. So the more people, the more researchers in the field we can get collaborating and working on these experiments to help enhance these critical algae, as well as to ensure that this strategy can be beneficial to the reef, the better. And with the end goal being as fast as possible, we would hope to employ such experiments.
A lot of people are hoping that you're going to be able to do that. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Rachel Levin is currently a postdoctoral scientist working on genetic engineering of a specific algae to help reduce coral bleaching. She's part of the growing research focus at multiple labs across Australia. You can find out more about her work on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, Jupiter and Saturn can be seen in the southwestern sky through the night. Jupiter will be setting at around 10:30 p.m., followed by Saturn at 2 a.m. Our moon will be passing through its full phase this week, so spotting those faint objects in the heavens is going to be quite challenging indeed.
This week, we're headed back up to the Mauna Kea summit, apparently a discovery there that relates to lightning.
Yes, last week we witnessed some spectacular video and images of atmospheric lightning captured by the Gemini Observatory on Mauna Kea. This remarkable footage captured a rarely seen occurrence when lightning heads up into the atmosphere rather than down, seemingly defying our experience of how lightning behaves.
Yeah, it is unusual. Usually we see lightning, it's headed down to the Earth, so what would cause it to happen to be headed upwards?
Well, the path of lightning is determined by how well its surroundings conduct electricity and how much electrical charge is built up. Lightning can move between clouds and also travel through the air to the Earth. What we don't normally see is it traveling upwards. But it's not really a surprise if the conditions turn out to be right.
You're saying that if there's something to conduct the electricity and it happens to be above, then the lightning will go that way?
There's no reason why it shouldn't.
And we see a lot of lightning here on Earth. There's lightning throughout the solar system and basically the universe, correct?
Yes. In fact, lightning on Earth is rather tame when compared to storms on some of the other planets. Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn all have ferocious lightning storms. For example, on Jupiter, the lightning never stops. Ever.
You've told us about some of these places. They sound downright frightening. Definitely not a place you plan on doing any experimental landings.
Absolutely not.
And in the more distant aspects of the universe, they have evidence of lightning in faraway spots?
Indeed, there is. Recently, we were able to detect bursts of radio energy that are consistent with electrical storms on a planet called HAT P11, around 124 light years away. Truly an electrifying discovery.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer, and informative too. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Earlier in the show, we took a dive into the ocean for a look at Fungia scutaria. Fun to say, isn't it? Also known as mushroom coral. Like many species of coral reef, mushroom coral contribute to a vast ecosystem that provides shelter and food for countless native plant and animal species near Hawaii. Observers have often described the appearance of the species as similar to the underside of a mushroom cap, and that's why it has the name mushroom coral. It is, in fact, though, a species of stony coral with a hard outer surface. The species is most commonly found on flat reefs, lodge into crevices and cracks, and commonly observed. Specimens range in size from 1 to 7 inches in diameter. Now, mushroom coral isn't the only nickname for Fungia scutaria. So for today's backyard quiz, we asked you to tell us the other nickname. And nobody knew that the answer is razor coral. So we'll keep our little tote bag until tomorrow. And if you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Okay, so be honest. How much do you know about the Federal Reserve System? Well, your first thought might be monetary policy and setting the short-term interest rates. The San Francisco Fed has come up with a game to help explain the impact of interest rate decisions on the economy. It's called Share the Fed, where you get to set interest rates and then see the impact of your decisions on the economy. Jody Hoff of the San Francisco Fed recently spoke with HPR's Bill Dorman and explained the main point of the game is to help with the mission of education.
How do we help people understand more about what the Fed is trying to do with monetary policy and that short-term interest rate called the Fed funds rate?
How do people respond to this, and what sort of reaction do you get from folks?
Well, you know, I think people are delighted just the fact that they can learn about a little bit more about monetary policy without having to dig into a textbook or some deep economic research paper. I understand, Bill, maybe that you all had been playing the game in your offices.
We have. It sort of got around, and it's quite the challenge. It's not, monetary policy is not as easy as some people may think.
Well, the economy is a complex organism, basically, and when you think about how the Fed is setting monetary policy to try to keep the economy on track and to meet our dual mandate goals, it is a complicated process.
So, Jody, I got to ask you, WalletHub did a recent survey of Americans, and they surveyed about 1,000 Americans. 50% think rate hikes make mortgages more expensive. 16% think the Fed is in charge of credit scores. So in terms of education, you've got kind of a challenge out there.
Well, you know, on those numbers that you just quoted to me are really interesting, and I, you know, some of that may be on what we can do with a monetary policy game, but I think it's a good start, and what it, you know, one of the reasons that we were interested in the game in particular is that we have an interest, of course, in education and helping young people prepare themselves to be adults and to be interacting in the economy and understanding about, you know, what interest rates do and how they do impact the economy, and, you know, what are some of the Fed's roles and responsibilities, and clearly setting credit scores is not one of them, but people may not know that. But hopefully, as a result of playing the game, they get a better sense of what the Fed's responsibilities are and what monetary policy can and really can't do, because it's not a panacea necessarily.
But that idea of the relationship between interest rates and the economy, and you can use various analogies, whether it's the foot on the gas pedal as you lower rates, that you're stepping on the gas a little bit more, as you raise rates, you tap the brakes maybe a little bit. One of the past Fed chairmen famously described the Fed's role as taking away the punch bowl when the party gets
right
going. Is that something that, again, has the mission has stayed the same, perhaps, but on when it comes to communicating intentions, has the Fed become a bit more open than it used to be?
Well, you know, some of those are pretty deep questions, Bill, and I may not be the best person to comment on that, but I think it's pretty clear that the Fed has definitely tried to be more transparent in terms of what our goals and missions are, and being more thoughtful about communicating that on a real consistent basis. And, you know, you see Janet Yellen after FOMC meetings periodically giving press conferences, and, of course, she's testifying in front of Congress. And we have lots of speeches that are occurring around the country from Reserve Bank presidents. And, you know, here in San Francisco, our President John Williams is really committed to a very open and transparent schedule where he is out talking to diverse groups of people about what we're trying to do with the monetary policy piece. So I think you're absolutely right that there is a real commitment to more openness and transparency.
You know, and certainly while the setting of target zones for short-term rates is one function and through the Open Market Committee, that's not everything the Fed does. The division of different districts, District 12, where you are, includes Hawaii, where we are. What sort of information does the San Francisco Fed follow when it comes to Hawaii's economy?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, Bill. In terms of, you know, a lot of what you hear about the Fed's work is, of course, from a national perspective, but every district cares very deeply about what's going on in their local economies. And you know, as those local economies all contributed to that bigger aggregate picture, so we're interested in gathering information about what's happening locally, and we do that in a couple of ways. We do that through our local boards of directors, and we also have some advisory committees. And in fact, we have Peter Ho, who's the chairman and CEO of the Bank of Hawaii, who's a member of our head office board. And you know, Peter Ho is reporting regularly on conditions in Hawaii back to our board here. We also have a community advisory council that talks more about local communities and community development. And we have an individual there her name is Michelle Kahani. She's the executive director at the Native Hawaiian Advancement Group, and she also participates in providing information and insight about what's happening in Hawaii. The other thing I wanted to mention, Bill, that's actually a pretty readable report for folks that aren't economists, which is the Beige Book. And that those are updated on about 9 times a year.
And the Beige Book is that regional look at the regional economies of the United States.
That is, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it gets, you know, really interesting breakdown in terms of what's happening in local industry.
And it's called the Beige Book, by the way, just because once upon a time when it came out in a hard copy, the cover used to be beige, and that name has stuck with it over the years, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We have a number of different colors for those documentations, so that's kind of an old holdover. I don't think we actually have a physical beige book that comes out, but you can certainly get all that information is available at the Board of Governors website.
As part of the San Francisco Fed's community engagement group, and you spoke a bit in terms of Hawaii and field work and such, but how do you act to engage the community more broadly and again, beyond just the story of interest rates?
Well, one of the things that obviously we do a lot of outreach work, so I the group I manage deals primarily with educators. And so we have a programming that we do primarily for high school and college educators and try to get them more involved and engaged in learning more about the Fed and the Fed's role in the economy. We also have a community engagement group, a community development group that does tremendous work throughout the district in helping, and they partner with other community development groups to bring best practices in terms of what is it that contributes to growing vibrant and healthy communities.
And Jody, before we go, I got to ask you if there's one single point that is the most common point of misunderstanding when it comes to the Fed that you would like to illuminate our listeners about, what would that be?
Well, you know, the one that seems to come up, and it may seem kind of obvious to some folks, is that the Fed really is engaging. Our mandate is in the financial markets. You know, we're stewards of this thing called the dual mandate, which is about stable prices and maximizing employment. But we don't do things like fiscal policy, and that is one of the most common misperceptions that I see, Bill, much like people thinking that the Fed was engaged in creating credit scores. We don't do that, and we also don't do fiscal policy.
You can get a sense of this with Chair of the Fed, the game of the San Francisco Fed. Jody Hoff is Director of Education and Outreach at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Thanks very much for joining us, Jody.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
And you can find the link to Chair of the Fed under the conversation page on our website. Just look at hawaiipublicradio.org. On any day, there are so many different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama keeps track of a lot of those, and he joins us now for a look at some of the events in our community that as we look at it, might be a little under the radar.
Yeah, a little.
Just a little. So today, let's talk about something first that's going to be happening at the Waikiki Aquarium.
That's right. You were talking about coral earlier on today's show, and tomorrow there's a lecture on coral at the Waikiki Aquarium. Dr. Les Watling from UH Manoa will discuss research that he's doing with the Schmidt Ocean Institute aboard the ship Falkor. The lecture is entitled Finding Boundaries in the Sea, Alaska, Hawaii, and the Emperor Seamount Chain. And Dr. Watling will also show photos during this presentation. It's at the Waikiki Aquarium from 3:30 to 4:30 tomorrow. It is free, but you need to RSVP at the link on our website.
Should be pretty interesting. We've had some conversations with the Schmidt Ocean Institute about what they've done with Falkor.
Yes.
And many of its trips should be a very interesting thing tomorrow at the Waikiki Aquarium. Also going on tomorrow, if you are more of a literary person, you might want to check in with some of Kona's authors.
The monthly Words and Wine event is hosted by Kona Stories Bookshop, and tomorrow's featured authors are Susan Scott, who wrote a book on the Pacific Golden Plover, or Kolea. Tricia Gunberg will discuss her fitness book, and Hilo-born Rochelle De La Cruz will talk about her book of essays titled Hawaii Ways, which includes some material that she wrote when she was a commentator here at HPR. Remember?
I remember those days.
I
do. So that's tomorrow at 6 at Kona Stories in the Keahau Shopping Center, yeah?
Yes, and the event
free?
Is free to the public.
Oh, good. Now, what about this on Maui tomorrow, a benefit for the birds?
It's happening at the Flat Bird Company in Paia. A percentage of flat bird bread sales.
Not flat bird.
No, yes. We'll go to the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project tomorrow from 5 to 10.
All right. Thanks so much. Derek Malama joins the conversation every day to take a look at some of the events that might just be under the radar. You can find a lot more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
And that's going to do it for us for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about collaborative care for the mentally ill. Dr. Jeffrey Akaka will be here. And from Hawaii Island, longtime solar advocate Marco Mangelsdorf will join us for a look at the nexus of grid modernization and the utilities power supply improvement plan, both the subject of recent PUC decisions. Now, you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if you've got something to tell us, or post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you want to tweet me, I'll answer you back at BKOZHPR. If you missed any of this show or just want a past one, you can find it all on The Conversation page. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back tomorrow to meet up with you for more of The Conversation.